We're checking in with EMS here on the COVID vaccine. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Wisconsin launched phase 1B, 1B of the vaccination distribution this week, allowing firefighters and law enforcement personnel to get vaccinated. To date, the state has administered more than 239,000 doses, with nearly 36,000 people having received their second dose. And mobile vaccination teams are set to be dispatched to scale up the rollout. First responders, have you been vaccinated or have you learned of an anticipated date? How is your stress level and mental health amid the pandemic? Have you gotten used to the amount of PPE you wear on the job? It's 800-642-1234. Alan DeYoung is Executive Director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, EMS has been part of this first tier of the vaccination distribution, this phase 1A. How is it going?
I think it was a little rough at first, not really having a clear communication plan for EMS as a whole. You know, a lot of people look to us, a lot of our members look to us and say, how do we get it? So there really wasn't a great plan at first, but they've started rolling out, you know, with contacting local public health centers across the state, having them kind of be the coordinators of not necessarily always distribution, but at least of communication. Some are doing distribution as well, which is kind of great to hear. And then also we've heard that hospital systems across the state have kind of stepped up and reached out to their local services to help out with the vaccination kind of process.
Ellen, do you find public health departments are taking different approaches to scheduling, to administering, to how to get the vaccine for your EMS personnel?
Yeah, definitely. Not all public health centers, you know, public health counties, they not all have the same resources, the same funding to be able to handle distributing it themselves. And so they're kind of looking to who else can help, you know, the mobile vaccine teams that are starting to roll out. But a lot of them are looking to, you know, clinics or hospitals in their county to, you know, help with this process, because some may have the resources, a lot do not, especially in the north.
How many EMS personnel do we have in our state?
So there's around 20,000 or so, I say, EMS providers that are licensed. Whether or not they run with a service may be a different question. Normally about 18,000 are directly running with a department anywhere in the state. So it's a substantial group of people.
Do you have any indication what percentage have been vaccinated so far?
Not any indication yet.
Okay.
I mean, you know, knowing the 240,000 so far that they said have been vaccinated, you got to think phase 1A is about 450,000 people. So even just based on that, you're saying about half of EMS, half of dentists, half of phase 1A has been vaccinated, and we're already moving on to phase 1B.
How are EMS workers highly encouraged to get the vaccine? Are they required? What is that like?
At this time, I haven't heard any requirements necessarily, but we are definitely encouraging EMS workers because they have this greater risk. You know, they're three times as likely to get COVID than nurses, five times as likely to get it than physicians, which you would think nurses, physicians, you know, they're probably the highest risk, but EMS even higher, because most of the time when they're going on a call, they don't know what they're getting into. They have some information or sometimes very, very little information. So, you know, wearing all the PPE they possibly can if they have access to it, you know, that they can do what they can, but they still have a higher risk.
We're talking with Alan DeYoung, who is the executive director of the Wisconsin EMS Association, and he's telling us how first responders are doing in the pandemic and the vaccine rollout to date. EMS workers, we want to hear from you. Have you been vaccinated? What's your experience been like working in this public health crisis? What support do you need? 800-642-1234 to join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan, how much do EMS responders know about the COVID status of an emergency call when they respond to an emergency situation and they walk into that environment?
A lot of times, very little, unless specifically the 911 dispatcher has been told that this person has COVID-19 symptoms, or that the person knows that they tested positive for COVID-19. So if they're going into an assisted living facility that they know that that individual tested positive, at least they have that information sometimes ahead of time. But most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, they're just going based on symptoms. They're trying to get there. They're trying to, triage the situation, whatever it is, and make sure that the patient or is stable, in any fashion, whether they need transport or not.
Is there any follow-up to that? If there is, if you learn in the follow-up that someone on that call had, was exposed to COVID?
Yeah, so I mean, when somebody like that, when it happens, when they have a positive, case that they know about, many times they're going to have their staff, the EMS providers, tested immediately. And if they have to quarantine for that sake, they most departments require it. There've also been some departments that have actually basically told their employees that you can't go out of the county. There's no going on vacation somewhere in the state or anything like that. It's, if you do, you're going to have to quarantine for 14 days, when you come back. So there's other restrictions being placed on that too. And so it's not only just the call that you're going into that you have a risk of COVID, but then, risk anywhere else in the state, and your job is kind of on the line.
What is the dispatch building like now as your responders around the state, wait to go out on calls? What are some of the precautions they're taking, especially around PPE, personal protective equipment?
Well, most of the time now, this was unlike in the past. Every EMS provider is wearing a mask. They're wearing coveralls. They're wearing shoe coverings if need be. They're wearing the face shields if they have them available. But with obviously with the shortage, earlier in 2020, that thing made things very costly for EMS services, which are already hurting as is revenue wise. And EMS is non-essential in the state, which means there's no funding for them. So not only do you have to pay for expensive PPE, and they have to use it on every call because they need to protect their workers. They're also hurting because they're seeing some reduction in how many calls they're getting. People are scared to, go to the hospital now, and for the sake of possibly getting COVID.
Is there training at all for EMS to put on PPE correctly and efficiently and take it off safely?
Absolutely. Yeah, we they something we kind of teach on early on, that is, downing and doffing, PPE properly, similar to how nurses and physicians are taught. But nowadays too, department meetings that normally held once a month are now all virtual because they're trying to reduce the risk there as well. Just like most companies, but these are people that normally a lot of times it's hands-on training that's needed. They need to see it in person. They need to do it. They need to practice it, because it is a skilled position.
Ellen DeYoung is Executive Director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. As we check in on the work of first responders amid the pandemic and the rollout of the vaccine for this group, do you work in a local health department? How are you getting COVID vaccines to first responders? Have you had an emergency during the pandemic? What was your experience with EMS? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Ellen DeYoung here on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on EMS on the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkant. Police and fire personnel are officially eligible to receive the COVID vaccine as part of the Phase 1B distribution launched this week. That's the second mass category of Wisconsinites eligible to get a vaccine. According to the Department of Health Services, local health departments are leading the coordination of getting vaccines out to this group. Are you a first responder? Have you been vaccinated or anticipate it soon? What is it like for you to get through a shift? How do you manage the stress of the pandemic? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. We're talking with Alan DeYoung. He leads the Wisconsin EMS Association, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. Alan, what challenges have EMS workers in Wisconsin faced as they respond to calls during the pandemic?
I would say quite a few. The main one I would say being their mental health, not only for the risk of getting COVID, but then the risk of bringing it home to families and, you know, not being able to see their parents who may be, you know, elderly, higher risk. So their mental health is already, you know, hurting from the type of calls that they see, you know, whether they be accidents or, you know, a lot of times pediatrics, you know, when small kids pass, that's a huge mental health burden on EMS providers. But now we're throwing on the potential, you know, you could expose other people to COVID-19 as well. They could be your family. They could be your friends. And we've had EMS providers get it that have gotten COVID on the call and have passed or not. Yeah. So it's a huge burden right now.
Have EMS seen an influx in calls at all, or maybe a decrease since the pandemic started? We have heard of people delaying in care, and especially when it would be even urgent care to get some medical problems taken care of.
Correct. Yeah, definitely. I've heard it firsthand from many departments that they've seen a huge reduction in their amount of calls, which doesn't necessarily mean a good thing either. EMS services in the state of Wisconsin being considered non-essential by the state, that means there's no funding for them. And so when you think about when you get an ambulance ride and you get a bill for it, that's how they generate revenue to cover their expenses. So less calls means less revenue to even break even. EMS has never, you know, broken even on just covering their costs for an ambulance ride. So with the reduction in calls overall, EMS is definitely struggling, and it's already been in a crisis. COVID-19 has just kind of exacerbated that, definitely.
And then there's the extra cost, I would assume, of PPE, how to afford that additional equipment.
Correct. Yeah. So PPE being, you know, shortages everywhere, everybody has to pay more because they have to have it. They have to protect their people no matter what. But they don't have the same funding as, say, you know, a hospital system would or a surgery center would, you know, in terms of PPE and just for anything else. That's the hard thing for most people to comprehend in the state of Wisconsin and, you know, 30 plus other states, no matter what the news says of EMS being essential, by the state law, EMS is considered non-essential, which means that it's not required. Only in towns in the state of Wisconsin is it actually essential, which means the town has to provide EMS service. So if you dial 911 and you don't live in a town necessarily, nobody may show up. I mean, most of the time they're going to, but if they're run by volunteers, and they, for some reason, can't make it because they might only have one ambulance. They might only have two ambulances, and they're already out on calls. Now you're kind of in a pickle type of thing, but this is life and death. So it's hard to think that don't my taxes go towards it? Yes, in some sense of if you live in Milwaukee, if you live in Madison, but the rest of the state, it kind of depends where you are. Most of the time, your taxes do not go to covering it. That's where the ambulance bills can't come in. That's where the spaghetti dinners and pancake breakfasts, which they no longer can have because of COVID, that's where their fundraising was. That's how they can afford some of the equipment and everything. So it's really been hit hard.
When you look at these small communities that are run by volunteer first responders, volunteer fire departments, that word volunteer, do you find that it is more difficult to find these people who are willing to do these jobs?
Definitely. And that's kind of a part of it being non-essential because you're not being paid. They might be paid a per call or on call, but that they don't fit under the federal or even state minimum wage standards. So they're not even getting minimum wage. Yet you're asking them to volunteer for 8-hour shifts, 12-hour shifts, 24-hour shifts, and to risk their life getting COVID, to risk their mental health seeing everything that they have to experience. So it's really hard to find people nowadays that are willing to volunteer because it's difficult.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Alan DeYoung, who is Executive Director of the Wisconsin EMS Association, and we're checking in with them on how emergency medical care personnel are holding up in the pandemic, as well as vaccine rollout for this group of personnel. You can join in. Do you work on EMS? Have you been vaccinated? What has your experience been like amid a public health crisis? Maybe you work for a volunteer fire department. What support do you need? 800-642-1234. We heard from Ian in Milwaukee, called in, couldn't stay with us. Ian is a truck driver, and Ian's noticed that EMS traffic has declined significantly, which doesn't make sense to Ian. People must still be getting sick, he says. What's going on?
Yeah, that kind of goes with the decrease in calls. I mean, you know, more people are scared to go to the hospital for, you know, possibly contracting COVID. They're delaying, like we've kind of heard, delaying surgeries or just care in general. So that's where you're probably seeing quite a bit of, you know, less. Also, there's just less people on the road. So less people on the road means less accidents and less need for EMS in that sense. That's what's been happening.
Well, on the funding piece, some counties and municipalities have been looking into new funding models for emergency services. And the Wisconsin Policy Forum has some reports on what consolidation would look like. What is your take on these alternative funding ideas and consolidation?
Consolidation itself, when you say TMS, they, you know, kind of cringe a little bit, which I understand. But in certain areas, consolidating to like a county level service makes sense. Not everywhere does it make sense because geographically in the state of Wisconsin, you know, some places are hard to access. But creating almost what we've seen a lot of times, even in southeastern Wisconsin, are districts, which is, you know, the combination of multiple villages or cities or towns or whatever it is to create a district of EMS and fire a lot of times. They can share resources. They can save a lot of times. They can actually then pay people. They have the funding combined across. So not everywhere does it work. There are certain instances that certainly I think that we should be looking at. How do we set up a different kind of model that they're going to respond to calls in a you know, timely amount of time, and they're going to have the resources to, you know, fund it in that sense.
Run a department, yeah. Let's bring in Kelsey now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, thank you so much for this conversation. I work in long-term care, and I also had my first serious car accident just a month ago. I have nothing but the highest regard for EMS. I am heartbroken to hear that they're considered non-essential. Thank you so much for bringing this to all of our attention. My question is basically, who should we be calling? Is there lobbying? Is there any legislation on the table? Not only for the dignity of our EMS workers, but also, you know, like you're discussing, for the benefit of our community to be safer.
Kelsey, thank you for that. Alan.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've pushed for many years to try to make EMS essential, and a lot of it comes down to, I hate to say this, but funding and taxes. You know, nobody wants to increase taxes, and I understand that, believe me, but when it comes to something like this, for many people, if you're dialing 911, it's a life or death situation. You know, I've known people that have had a heart attack, and thankfully their service was within minutes, you know, of their house. So they lived, but that's not always the case because of funding. And so really calling, you know, our legislators and trying to, you know, get this on in front of them, saying, hey, we've been pushing for this for a while. It's life and death. It's EMS. Police and even garbage is considered essential in the state. Garbage is, although it's, you got to have it, it's not necessarily life and death. So, I mean, that's why we encourage everybody to talk with their legislators, their representatives in the area. We would love to actually get EMS considered essential by the state to have, you know, some funding. So it's available everywhere in our state.
We only have a few seconds left, but are there any practices that have started since COVID for EMS workers that you see will continue after the pandemic is over?
I could see possibly the PPE, the mask, you know, being kind of a now kind of essential for them. It helps stop the spread of so many other things as well. And I could see that continuing just for the sake of, you know, everybody's safety because they're dealing with the higher risk, you know, individuals.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. I appreciate it.
Alan DeYoung is Executive Director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. Coming up, we get an update on how restaurants across the state are doing amid the pandemic and a proposal to allow bars and restaurants to offer alcoholic drinks to go. What do you think about this proposal? 800-642-1234. We'll check in on restaurants right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been 1 year since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in the U.S., and thousands of Wisconsinites continue to test positive every day. While there's no silver bullet for avoiding hospitalization, Bram Sable-Smith reports experts have developed tips for treating the disease.
Morgan Steiner struggled to decide whether to drive from Waterloo to Marshfield to visit family for Christmas. The 29-year-old knew traveling risked exposure to the coronavirus. On the other hand, she had a really hard year. Like a lot of us, she missed family milestones while spending the year in isolation.
And I think I just got overconfident, and I went up to visit my sister and her husband and their kids.
It was a good Christmas, but 2 days later, she got the call. Her sister had symptoms. Steiner got tested herself, and the results came back on New Year's Day. She had COVID-19.
That just goes to show you can be so careful and you can just make one mistake. You can just let your guard down a little bit and that's when it could get you.
Wisconsin saw a spike in new cases after the holidays. And while there's no cure for COVID, experts have developed a decent sense for what helps. Steiner and her husband followed many of these practices and they hope their experience can help others. Step one is isolating. Steiner's husband, Andrew, did not travel and tested negative for COVID. They wanted to keep it that way, so he slept on the couch. UW Health's Nasia Softar says that's a good start.
So ideally a dedicated room and a bathroom if that's available. If it isn't possible, then I think everyone in the house should be wearing masks when they're around you if you're sick.
That includes the sick person, too. And Softar says other basic hygiene is important, like hand washing, cleaning high-touch surfaces, and keeping air circulating with open windows, fans, or air purifiers.
The aerosols that sort of hang around in the air, it's good to move around the air so that it can waft them away, whether it's natural or artificial.
Step two, monitor your symptoms. So far, Morgan Steiner has not had a fever, but she checks it twice a day. Michael Landrum from Bell & Health in Green Bay says that's a good idea. He also suggests using something called a pulse oximeter. It's about $30 and can be bought online or at a pharmacy. It clips to a fingertip and measures your blood oxygen level.
That's important because that's really one of the prime warning signs that things could be getting worse.
Landrum says a typical blood oxygen level is around 98 to 99%. If you have COVID and it dips below 94 and doesn't get better when you take a few deep breaths,
then that should be a sign that at least call your doctor.
Shortness of breath and other breathing difficulties may also signal that COVID is progressing to a point that might need hospitalization. A pulse oximeter can help detect that early. Step three, treat your symptoms. The only real remedy Morgan Steiner used was a bottle of nasal spray, but she also ate healthy, got rest, and drank liquids. Landrum says, right on.
The old adages you got from your mom or grandma are still true with this.
If you do develop a fever, both Landrum and Softar say you should treat it with a fever reducer, like ibuprofen or Tylenol. Either one is fine and should help other likely symptoms like muscle aches. There's also some evidence that people with low levels of vitamin D are more likely to contract COVID or develop more severe symptoms. A vitamin D supplement could be helpful, but just to bring your levels up to normal. And Softair says there's one more treatment to ask your doctor about, monoclonal antibodies. That's the IV treatment President Trump got back in October.
Not everyone needs them, but if you have high-risk conditions, it's good to at least discuss the possibility of should you be getting those.
Morgan Siner is out of isolation now. She still feels guilty about contracting COVID, but she's thankful her symptoms weren't worse. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this story comes from a reporting partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Just a heads up on our coverage plans for Inauguration Day tomorrow. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be sworn in as the next president and vice president of the U.S. Join us for live NPR coverage from the U.S. Capitol starting at 10. That's live inauguration coverage tomorrow morning at 10 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now we're checking in on how restaurants are doing and a new proposal for alcoholic drinks to go that's circulating in the legislature. Under the proposal, restaurants and bars could sell mixed drinks and glasses of wine packaged with a tamper evidence seal. It's a move to help a struggling industry. New data out from the National Restaurant Association. Overall losses for 2020 totaled $240 billion. Are you in the restaurant business? What do you need now? What do you think of this cocktails to go bill? It's 800-642-1234. Christine Hilmer is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Christine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, explain this legislation, selling to go cocktails or to go wine by the glass. How does it work?
So what it would mean is if you want to enjoy with your carryout food your favorite margarita or your favorite old-fashioned or if a restaurant has a signature cocktail, they can mix it up to the proper proportions. They can put it in a sealed container, and you can take it with your to-go order. And what it means is it provides the restaurant with an additional revenue source, and it provides anybody who wants to do this with that great cocktail that they can enjoy at home.
Now, you know, I mean, many states do this. I lived in Louisiana for many years where you see drive-through daiquiri shops in every corner. You know, you drive past a window, buy your daiquiri, away you go. And it's just this small piece of tape that prevents, you know, you from being, you know, pulled over or charged with driving with an open container. Is that the same approach here on the seal with a piece of tape?
There's a lot of different ways that you can seal it, but when we say tamper resistant, it means that you can obviously see that it has been opened in the car, and it really is no different than going to your liquor store or your convenience store and getting a can of beer and cracking it open when you're in the car. It's really no different than you take this cocktail and you open it up, and it's obvious that it has been opened after you've left that facility. It's really no different. In Washington, D.C., I've seen some very creative ones that it's called a Fauci Pouchy, where basically it looks like a Capri Sun that the restaurant would fill with that favorite cocktail. They seal it, and off you go. But you know when it's been open, and that's the key to this. It's not an open intoxicant in the car. That's of great concern to us. That is not what this is. You know that it's been open after it's been left, after you've left the restaurant.
Where is the proposal now? Where is this bill now in the legislature?
Right now it has been proposed, and we are looking for co-sponsors in the legislature. In fact, today is the deadline to have that happen. So if anybody thinks that this is a good idea for Wisconsin, contact your legislator and let them know that they should be signing on to this bill. Of course, it's going to have to go to hearing, and it's going to have to go through the legislature and the whole process and eventually to the governor's office. But we've been in constant contact with his office as well as a lot of our legislators, and it looks pretty favorable. Of course, you can't say for sure if it's going to go, but we think that this is going to be a big boost for a lot of restaurants because they've lost a lot of that bar sale because they haven't been able to eat and dine in to their full capacity for a very long time.
Don't some mixed drinks need to be consumed right away, though? Things that have to be shaken or creamy cocktails, I'm thinking. Would some cocktails not lend themselves to this to-go fashion?
It's possible. And I would think that restaurants can help navigate you and let you know that, you know, this may not travel as well, but there's a lot that will. The other thing is that they could also mix it without the ice, because that's a factor in it, that it may melt and then it may disintegrate a little bit and get watered down. But we think that this is a great opportunity. And right now, one thing this does not allow for is for delivery of it. So if you have your food delivered, that cannot happen. We have another bill that we are working on to allow delivery companies to still have that face-to-face at the end of the transaction so they can check the ID. But right now, that is not part of this.
We're going to look at that legislation in a moment. But going back to these to-go cocktails, what about the critics who say if this law would go through, it would only contribute to more drinking and driving?
Well, again, it's no different than if you go to your local grocery store and you get a six-pack of beer and you choose to open up that can of beer in the car. How is it different? Because when it has left the restaurant, it is sealed. We are very concerned about drunk driving, of course. But those that are going to do it are going to find a way around it. And right now, it's not cocktails. It's going to be other things, but it's really no different. So this allows the restaurant to have that as a sale item, have that revenue so that they can survive, because that's ultimately what we're trying to do. We're trying to help restaurants survive the economic crisis that the pandemic has caused.
Financially speaking, how much could this help restaurants and bars?
It really varies, because it depends upon the model of the restaurant. But, you know, some restaurants, 30% of their sales are cocktails. Some of it's higher, some of it's lower, but that's about an average. And right now, they're not getting that as part of their sale process, and restaurants are hurting. We know that around the state, many, many restaurants are doing the right thing. They're distancing their tables. They're having their staff wear their masks and so on. They've reduced the capacity of seats, and we need them to be able to have some additional revenue sources in order to just survive.
Are restaurants able to sell drinks of any kind right now, bars and restaurants, that are alcoholic for to-go?
Mm-hmm. So what they can do is they can sell alcohol that is factory sealed. And what that means is it's that can of beer that comes to them sealed from the factory, or a bottle of wine that the cork is intact, or even a bottle of spirits, you know, the brandy and vodka and so on. As long as that is factory sealed, you can buy that from a restaurant. And this just extends that you can add that favorite signature cocktail, put it in a sealed container, and off you go. So they already have the ability to sell those factory sealed items.
We're discussing conditions in the restaurant industry with the head of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, Christine Hilmer, with us. How did your restaurant adapt last year, and what does the future hold for 2021? Did your restaurant invest in outdoor patio seating for winter dining? What has that been like? What have you learned about staying afloat in a pandemic in the food service industry? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Christine Hilmer on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with the CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, Christine Hilmer. According to the National Restaurant Association, about 110,000 restaurants nationwide have closed their doors in the pandemic, many never reopening. That represents 1 in 6 eateries not able to make the numbers work. Dozens of states have relaxed laws around to-go alcohol sales in response to the economy. Wisconsin has legislation in the works. Getting your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Cindy now in Appleton. Hi, Cindy. What do you think?
Well, I get it. I understand everybody's hurting and that alcohol sales is a big part of the restaurants, but we have created so much additional garbage and litter because of all this to-go stuff that all this is going to do is just create more garbage for the landfills, and I just wish there was a better way to do this.
Christine, this is additional packaging that Cindy is really concerned about.
So I think that what we know is because of the delivery and the curbside, you're adding a lot of packaging to the restaurant industry. Trust me, we would prefer people to be sitting in the restaurant, and we would prefer to be able to pack them in and have that delicious food and have those craft cocktails in the restaurant. I completely get it. That's what we would prefer as well, but it's just not something that we can do right now. And it's just a sign of the times that with so much to go happening, there's going to be additional packaging. There's going to be an impact on the landfill. What's really cool is pre-COVID, there was a lot of suppliers that were working a lot of biodegradable to-go items. And I think that we're going to see a return to that, but unfortunately it's going to have to be after COVID is handled.
Christine, your association is also working on legislation that would allow for the delivery of alcohol in Wisconsin. You touched just a bit on this earlier. Can you explain why that is needed and what you're working on there?
It's an extension of the cocktails to go. And both of these bills haven't passed in almost 40 other states, most of them since COVID hit. And what the delivery option allows is if you order that pizza and you want a six pack, that six pack of beer can be delivered with that pizza. Or you order a great Italian dinner and you want a bottle of red wine with it, it can be delivered with it. But you have to remember that there is still mechanisms in place, that there still has to be a face-to-face ID check that will be required. It's not going to be allowed to just drop it off on a front porch without checking that ID. So there are mechanisms in place, and it's just basically extending that sale, and it's that face-to-face at the end of the sale versus at the restaurant itself.
So what about checking IDs with this? How would that work when you bring that order, when you deliver those groceries?
Well, there's a lot of ways you can do it, but the mechanism that we are talking about is that when you make the order itself, when you call in, you can give them the name and ID number of that individual making that order. And that individual making the order has to be the one that accepts it. And then you verify that ID upon delivery. So you still have that look and you make sure that they have the correct date on there, that they are 21 or older. Because the last thing we want to do is be able to allow people to deliver and it's to underage drinkers. That's not something that we would like to see. And so there will be safeguards in place.
So what is the framework here for grocery stores? Because people go online, pick out the items they want from the grocery store and place that order.
And it would be the same thing that right now grocery stores cannot deliver alcohol. And this would be extended to allow them to do it as well. And same mechanism, if you're going to have alcohol in your order, you have to have a way to make sure that the person who is making the order and then receiving the order is the age of 21 and has that ID check. It would be the same thing.
So are these two bills circulating together?
At this time, they are not. They are separate.
Okay.
We would be fine if they were together. We would be fine if they were apart. Right now, just functionally speaking, they are apart, and so we'll be working on them at the same time.
We're talking with Christine Hilmer, CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, whose members have 7,000 restaurant locations statewide. We're looking at the state of the industry with your questions as well about to-go alcohol, 800-642-1234. Christine, I want to get a read on how restaurants in Wisconsin are doing right now. What are you hearing?
I have to be honest, it's pretty rough. You know, statewide, we know that, and this is based on survey data that we received at the beginning of December, 37% of restaurants are at risk of closing now. And right now in January and February tend to be the slowest months in most restaurants. So we've got the pandemic, we've got reduced capacity, we've got a brutalized industry, and now we're in the winter. So it is pretty rough, and that's one of the reasons why that we think that if we can give them more tools, it will help them. Even coming out as we come out in the spring, we know that the vaccine is starting to get out there. It's going to take some time, and so we don't think that we're going to be able to see capacity limits lifted into the summer. and it's still a long haul. There's a lot of restaurants that are on the brink.
What do you know about outbreaks at restaurants, COVID cases at restaurants?
So there have been a number of studies done, and we've looked at a lot of the contact tracing data and so on. And right now, there is no study that shows that restaurants that are employing all the best practices, the hypersanitization, the social distancing, the mask wearing, there is no study to show that restaurants are a significant source of the spread. It's the data is not there. In fact, looking at the science, restaurants are not the cause of the spread. But we know that this is one way to help control it, and that's why a lot of folks have gone this route. We know that restaurants are doing everything they can to keep their employees safe, to keep their customers safe, and it really is a survival mechanism. What you have to remember is the ripple effect when a restaurant goes out of business. That's really important. It's not just that restaurant owner and their family. It's their employees and their families. But then you also have to look at the suppliers and the farmers and everybody who supports a restaurant. That ripple effect is vast. Nationally speaking, they're looking at 40% of restaurants nationally going out of business, and that was back in December. It's pretty dire out there, and so anything we can do to support restaurants is critically needed.
A number of restaurants have been investing in outdoor dining, you know, the technology, the filters, trying to get outdoor spaces warm enough, frankly. How has that gone?
Well, over the summer, it was a real boost to a lot of restaurants to be able to extend their dining outside. It was really neat to see the innovation and the great spaces that were put up. Unfortunately, we are in the middle of January, and we are in Wisconsin. We are in a cold climate. So a lot of those spaces just are not usable right now. We do know that they do have igloos, and they've got greenhouses and other things. So they've been really creative, which is great to see. But some of the outdoor dining just isn't practical in the middle of winter. Of course, as we go in spring and things warm up a little bit, then they'll be able to reuse them. But you are absolutely right. They have extensively invested in safety protocols and things to keep their staff and their customers safe.
We heard from Judy in Appleton, who writes, here is a compromise. Take out alcohol to go cocktails could be permitted if, Judy says, we also raise the alcohol tax to fully account for the effect of inflation since the last time the tax was adjusted. What do you make of Judy's proposal?
Alcohol is already taxed, and it's a sin tax. And so it is already taxed. So I don't necessarily see why we would need to increase taxes on that even further.
So as we wrap up here, a couple more seconds left, what advice are you giving to restaurants around the state?
So most restaurants are at a reduced capacity, but even at a reduced capacity, there are seats in a restaurant. Go visit them. But when you go into a restaurant, please follow the safety protocols that those restaurateurs have put into place to keep their staff safe and keep you safe. So please follow them. Arguing with them on whether or not you believe in masks and so on is just not helpful. But you can also do curbside delivery. So, and that's where you can call. You can make your order of your favorite fish fry, Italian dinner, pizza, whatever. You go to the restaurant. They will contact a contactless, drop that into the backseat of your car or in your trunk, however you want to do it. Or you can also do delivery.
So lots of options. Christine, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Christine Hilmer is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Just ahead, we talk with the president of the Human Rights Campaign. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.